The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Columbia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. This is me, your host, Richard McCall. This is episode 332 of the Columbia Calling podcast. And while I recorded the third segment of this show with QC, just John McKendrick QC, talking about the history of the ill-fated settlement by the Scots in Panama. I recorded that in Bogota a few days ago. On Saturday, we fled as a family from Bogota up to the coast, up to Mompós, where I have my businesses. And precisely that was the reason why we were allowed to drive the 12 hours from Bogota to Mompós en famille. The idea is that we downloaded a permission slip from the Ministry of Transport saying that we are small business owners, all true, of course, and we needed to go and oversee the biosecurity methods being employed in our hotels for the reopening. Then, of course, we printed out the relevant documents, the route, the Cámara de Comercio, and everything else, and a letter from myself to myself authorizing my family's journey. So we're up here now in a big colonial house with internal gardens, views over the Magdalena River, family around us in a setting with 7 cases of COVID-19, worrying all the same because it is the coast and Barranquilla and Cartagena and all the informal workers out there are much at risk, and many of whom are getting back on clandestine buses back to their small towns because they can no longer pay the rent in these big cities. So there is a spread around the Colombian coast that is being unchecked and unrevised because we weren't stopped in 5 checkpoints from Bogota to the coast, but we were stopped by 2 informal checkpoints upon arriving in Guamal Magdalena and upon leaving in Guamal Magdalena. And these were just for money and for food because the people are suffering greatly. This week, we've got a new news presenter on the show, hopefully a long-term relationship. Her name is Emily Hart, and she knows her Columbia very well, and she'll be bringing you the news in the second segment of this show. She is affiliated to Columbia Reports. And then we'll be going into segment 3 with John McKendrick QC, so a barrister speaking very, very well and very eloquently about his book on the Scottish settlement in Panama. So, of course, a fascinating piece of history that we may all have heard about, but have not gone as depth into as Mr. McKendrick has. And he speaks about this with a passion that only a Scot could have for this dream of empire, perhaps, and dream of a colony to enrich the Scottish nation, but which resulted in something quite different. So again, please, share the podcast, let everybody know about it. This is 332. We're still going strong. I know you've been enjoying our strength of podcasts of late, and Manuel Rueda last week giving us a news overview was very popular indeed, just as was Jenny Smith 2 weeks ago talking about the Alzheimer mutation, the Pisa mutation, bringing on early onset Alzheimer's in Antioquia and around Colombia and South America. So again, please support us. Please spread the word and don't go away. Listen now to Emily Hart with the news report, and we'll be back in segment 3 with John McKendrick QC. Thank you again and bye-bye.
I'm Emily Hart, and this is the news for Columbia Calling for the week of July 6th, 2020. Colombia has now passed 100,000 cases of coronavirus, with 3,900 fatalities so far. The peak is expected to arrive in August. Bogota has received a boost in its intensive care capacity, but a second lockdown has been announced in Medellin after a sharp rise in COVID-related hospitalizations and fear about the collapse of the health system there. The health system in Caribbean city Barranquilla is reported to be on the verge of collapse even amid a militarized lockdown. The region is fast becoming the global epicenter of the virus. More than half of all global COVID deaths last week were in Latin America. The World Bank has reported that the coronavirus crisis could cost Latin America two decades of development, plunging 50 million people below the region's poverty line, under a daily income of $5.50 US. In addition, the International Monetary Fund has predicted a sharp 9.4% contraction of Latin American economies this year, with slow reopening in years to come. Colombia's over-70s have gained freedom, winning a legal case against President Iván Duque's measure, which intended to keep them in extended obligatory confinement until the end of August. Known as the White-Haired Rebellion, the case had seen the health measure shot down in court. The judge criticised it as paternalistic and unconstitutional, a violation of rights to equality and freedom of movement. The president plans to appeal the decision. Seven soldiers pled guilty to the rape of 13-year-old indigenous girl from the Embera community in the Risaralda province. The indigenous authorities demanded that the soldiers be surrendered to them and tried under indigenous law before being tried under common criminal law. The National Army refused to cooperate and jailed the soldiers after closing a plea deal with the Prosecutor General. This news comes in the wake of months of scandals for the Colombian Army, ranging from a spy network to a string of rapes and sexual abuse of minors. According to a survey this week, the Army's approval rating among Colombians now stands at 48%, the lowest since records began. Colombia's government has announced the death of John Freddy Cortez Buritica, alias Dumar or Culebrito, an ELN commander involved in the attack on a Bogotá police academy in January 2019. A car bomb which killed 22 and injured a further 89. Duque claims Dumar financed the attack on the police academy. He was also a commander at the right hand of Gustavo Aníbal Giraldo, known as Pablito, the military leader of the ELN. During the same operation on the Venezuelan border, eight men were captured and are now being interrogated about the attack. That was this week's news bulletin. Now back to Columbia Calling with Richard McCall.
And we're back. This is the final segment of episode 332 of the Columbia Calling podcast. I'm Richard McCall here in Bogota, Colombia. 2,600 metres closer to the stars, and our very special guest this week is John McKendrick QC. He's in Sussex in the UK at this moment. We're very lucky to get him on the line. Very busy man, 20 plus years of litigation experience, 2 years as the Attorney General in Anguilla, and, well, he wrote a book, and the book is what is of interest, not only John, of course, but the book is of interest to us because it's about the Darien Gap, and we have been following this theme a bit this year, but it's called Darien, A Journey in Search of Empire, and it's about the Scottish settlements in the Darien, and most of us, most of my listeners, all of you guys out there, will have heard something about this folly into the jungle, but I don't want to say, I won't take anything away from what John has to say. Just let's say, welcome on Columbia Calling, and thank you for agreeing to be on this podcast.
Richard, good morning. It's great to join your podcast. Colombia is a country I love very much, so I'm very pleased to be able to speak to people who care about the history and culture and people of Colombia. And curiously enough, I began researching this book after, really, I suppose it was after a trip to Colombia. In 2003... I got fed up being a litigator in London and I took a career break and I went off to Mérida in Venezuela, where I spent 2 months drinking polar and trying to learn some Spanish. And from Mérida, I slid down the Andes in across the border and into Colombia. And I was enjoying Cartagena, Santa Marta, and especially back in those days, 17 years ago, the undeveloped beaches in Tayrona. And whilst I was there, I heard about six or eight, I can't remember how many people being kidnapped in Ciudad Perdida. And of course, then transpired that they were kidnapped by the ELN and those, for unfortunates were, I think, held for 100 days or so. And that sort of, I suppose, made me think, right, maybe it's time to move on. And then I had a brush with some unpleasant-looking people with guns on the beach in Tirana, and I decided, right, time to go somewhere else. So I went to Panama. And I hadn't really expected to go to Panama. And I didn't know what I'd think about it, but I remember on one of the endless journeys getting there, reading in my guidebook this box about Darien and the Scottish colony. And I'd known about it vaguely. It wasn't taught in the syllabus in Scottish history, but I had some background and was aware of it. No doubt my granny had told me about it growing up in and around Glasgow. And so I tried to find out a bit more about it in Panama, and where was the site of the old colony? Where was New Edinburgh and Fort St. Andrew? And where was this mythic Caledonia? And nobody knew very much. So I carried on traveling and eventually got back to the UK and decided to start digging around, and eventually bought quite a few books in and around the subject. And then I find myself living in Panama City about a year later. And I had time to go down to the Archivo Nacional in Panama City, and I started to dig around. And I thought there were some interesting things that still could be said. So what is this history of the Scots so close to Colombia in the Darien jungle? Well, the background really is owed to a chap called William Paterson, who was born in Dumfriesshire in the south of Scotland. And he had this amazing idea to create a trading colony in the Americas, to trade goods from Europe to the Americas to Asia. Mm-hmm. And he thought if you could have a entrepot economy in Panama, you would make money. And he thought that this part of Panama was not taken, in his language, by any European prince. Of course, he'd miscalculated massively there about the importance to the Spaniards of that part of the Spanish Empire and the importance of the Camino Real and the fact that the Barlovento fleet would take Spanish gold from the Caribbean coast back to Cadiz. But Paterson described this scheme like this. This is the only quotation I'll read out, but it's just so good it needs to be read. This was the idea behind the Scottish Darien scheme. The time and expense of navigation to China, Japan, and the Spice Islands, and the far greatest part of the East Indies, will be lessened by more than half, and the consumption of European commodities and manufactories will soon be more than doubled. Trade will increase trade, and money will beget money, and the trading world shall need to no more want for their work for their hands, but will rather want hands for their work. Thus, this door of the seas and the key of the universe, with anything of a sort of reasonable management, will of course enable its proprietors to give laws to both oceans without being liable to the fatigues, expenses, and dangers, or contracting the guilt and blood of Alexander and Caesar. So it was a relatively noble undertaking, which led six rather fine ships and 1,200 men and women to sail from Leith in 1698. And they sailed around the top of Scotland, down to Madeira, across the Atlantic, and into the northeast Caribbean, where they encountered Danes in St. Thomas, Spaniards off the coast of Cuba, and eventually, after a very long journey, they sailed down at the coast and made landfall at what is now called today Punta Escocés, which is about 40 kilometers from the Colombian-Panamanian modern-day border. And there they founded a settlement called New Edinburgh. They built a town. They established the Fort of St. Andrew, lookout points, defensive facilities all around this very large bay. But they weren't particularly well-equipped. And the journey itself had been arduous, and indeed William Paterson's own wife died just before they arrived, and a lot of people had been ill. So they weren't in great shape when they arrived. And then they had great difficulty actually trading the goods that they had brought. And many people have written about the fact that they brought lots and lots of tartan and bonnets and clay pipes and things like that, which nobody particularly wanted to trade in that area of the Caribbean at that time. They made friends with a lot of the Amerindians, and the Spanish already knew they were coming because, as your listeners will know, the Spanish intelligence network had its ears twitching as soon as these Scots arrived into the Caribbean. And the Spanish didn't think there was any difference between Scots and the English, even though they were separate countries in those days. Scotland and England only formed one country in 1707, although they shared the same king, a Dutchman, King William. So the first expedition floundered around trying to sell things and to make friends. But eventually, after many, many people have died, they conceded that they couldn't go on. And they particularly felt it was very difficult to go on after a proclamation was made by the governor, the English governor of Jamaica in April 1699, saying that no English colony would trade with the Scots in Caledonia. And so they decided they would have to flee home. And some of them fled to Jamaica, some to Cuba, some up to the States, to New York, and very few of them managed to get back home to Scotland. In September 1699, a second expedition of another 1,200 men and women left the Clyde on the west coast of Scotland and sailed back to find, when they eventually got there, 2.5 months later, that the colony had been abandoned. But they immediately set out rebuilding Fort St. Andrew, rebuilding the town, reconsecrating the church, and settled in. By this stage, of course, troops and soldiers from modern-day Mexico and from Colombia. A lot of ships were provisioned in Cartagena, and they sailed and created a fleet, a flotilla, to barricade the Scots. They landed men. There were a number of skirmishes in which there was very serious fighting taking place in the jungle with pistols and cannons. The Scots scored one smallish victory up in the hills in Darien in a place called Tubugante, where, in fact, the lead Spanish officer had actually sailed and marched his men from Panama City over the Cordillera and down, and the Scots went up to engage them and chase them off at this Battle of Tubugante, which was really the Scots' only significant victory. But the Scots made strategic errors, and eventually, when they were surrounded by the Spanish and with no drinking water left in Fort St. Andrew, they were forced to capitulate. And in early 1700, the Spanish took the surrender and sent the Scots marching. And so they left. And again, a bit like the soldiers and sailors of the first expedition, they fled really around the Caribbean, some to Jamaica, some up to Cuba, who were imprisoned in Spanish fortifications in Havana, who were eventually sent back to Cadiz and were traded back by the company several years later, and some went up to the United States, to Charleston, and I'll tell you a little bit more about the significance of that shortly, but that was it. I mean, it was a great disaster. Scotland had plied about half its available capital into the scheme. It bankrupt Scotland. It destroyed Scottish morale, and Darien, Panama, is probably the single most significant historical incident which led to the creation of Great Britain. Because with the destruction of the Scottish economy in 1700, 1701, it was much easier for the English to then persuade the Scots, who shared the same king, to dissolve their parliaments and have a union of parliaments in London, which led to the creation of a new country called Great Britain. Mm-hmm. And the Treaty of Union signed between Scotland and England at Article 8 had a provision called the Equivalent, which was the payment by the English to the Scots of £400,000 sterling, billions of money in today's money, which was the amount of money that was lost investing into the company that lost Scotland's shirt in the tropical jungles of Darien, so close to Colombia. So that's the story in a nutshell, Richard.
It's just a mind-boggling story. I mean, we hear about Darien Dhu, and we hear I find it such an attractive and inspirational, but then ultimately, well, I think we do like the underdog, don't we? And we do like the sort of the plucky loser in that. Not to put
Scotland as a whole. And let me just warn my listeners here, back in, you know, the 17th century, 18th century, my family was Scottish too, so therefore I'm on this side of things. God, it would be great to know if I had family that went on one of those boats or, you know, put some money towards it. But it was a government, I mean, the money went to the Scottish government, who then said, we will fund this trip to the New World.
Yes, the money went to what was a, in fact, it was a company with state backing. It was a bit like a modern day East India Company. Mm-hmm. So it was a company created by an act of the Scottish Parliament called the Company of Africa. Mm-hmm. And the money was, a huge amount of money was invested in it by all sectors of society with the backing of the state. But at the end of the day, we're shareholders who expected to make a profit. And the company could have been very successful, as your listeners will know. The Dutch East India Company, hugely successful. The English East India Company ruled India for a century. Why couldn't the Scots achieve it? Well, they couldn't achieve it because they were seduced into believing that Darien was a good place to position a colony. Now, that completely ignored the reality of the Spanish Empire, but also the living conditions, and people couldn't live in a place like that at that stage. The contemporary accounts are full of people dying of the flux and the flu, and of course we can imagine dysentery and malaria and yellow fever just went through the ranks of people. And add on to that the Scottish habit of enjoying a dram, some brandy and some rum. It was a pretty toxic mix, and therefore a lot of people died. But it's easy to look now and say this was obviously a bad idea. At the time, it didn't look like that. And these people were extremely brave. And a lot of what my book is about is trying to trace back their footsteps over 300 plus years of history to pay tribute to the brave men and women who made that journey into the unknown and who bravely felt that they were doing something which had great commercial sense, but also would do something to help Scotland get on the map. Because If the Portuguese could do it and the Dutch could do it, why couldn't small Scotland? And of course, we know this was a lucrative trade because whilst the Spanish adopted this mercantile approach of not trading with other people, they had the El Nao de China, the trade routes from Acapulco to the Philippines and onwards to China. So a lot of this Europe, Americas, Indies trade existed. But of course, that was lucrative, and the Spanish weren't going to give any of it up without a fight. And so the Scottish rewriting of history, which I try to correct in my book based on the archival research, is that it's not right to say that the Scots failed because of a jealous England. The Scots failed because of the decisions they made themselves. And that, I think, is an important part of this in the last few hundred years.
Yeah, I mean, what I think about, you look at a map or the maps that would have existed in the time, and of course, geographically, looking at the map, Panama, I mean, this area looks great, but that whole sort of blockade of the other European designs in the Caribbean, the Spanish, the Dutch, as you said, the Danes, the English, and so on, I mean, that's pretty formidable. Having to get through that first. There's a whole lot of ocean and so on, but you're going to follow the trade routes and you're going to follow the winds. And so therefore, the ships end up getting pushed into the same areas, I would imagine. And then, of course, those distances get minimized. But you look at it and you're like, it makes sense. And the distances were so much larger. And as you said, you talked about that battle that the Scots won up on the hill. Had they been a bit more successful, let's not talk about the actual living conditions, but had they beaten back the Spaniards again, I presume that the Spaniards would have come at them again, but maybe with a bit more, you know, they would have been a bit more cautious about it. Now, the Scots are embedded here, we've dug in. We'll blockade them from the sea, you know, we'll do it this way or something. But it all turned out differently. I've not read your book. I will read it. My list of books to read is immense. But during this very extended lockdown that we're living, I'm doing very well. I put it through. I was Yeah. I was curious to know that if you were you able in your book to follow certain individuals, like from different social strata from Scotland who went out? I mean, we could know about Paterson, of course, because he's the guy that headed it. But I would be more interested of people, I would say, of the working class who were, you know, manning the ropes on the boats, hoping to make a name for themselves or get a plot of land, much like happened with the English in Virginia or elsewhere. Were you able to trace some of these people back?
It's slightly hard to know what the social status of was of the various people involved. And that's partly because the Scots were forward thinking and therefore they were quite meritocratic. So they didn't use any form of military titles. So it's hard to understand the background of people's social status, apart from obviously the people at the very top. But yes, I mean, certainly I was able to trace back what happened to, for example, there was a Scotsman who was taken because he spoke Latin and French. And so he was brought on the expedition as an interpreter. And when the first expedition left Caledonia, they stopped at the Bay of Matanzas in the north of Cuba. And he was getting some fresh drinking water when the Spaniards seized him, and he was thrown into jail in Havana and then sent to Cadiz. And you have a very interesting account of his background and his life and what happened to him. There's also some Scottish sailors who, again, it's a little bit like what you were saying earlier, with the trade routes and the winds, it was quite a difficult area to sail. So people went around the same routes. The Scots went off to try and sell some provisions, and they sailed too close to Cartagena. And they ended up bashing their ship right on the side, I imagine, where Fort San Felipe is in historic Cartagena. And again, of course, they were seized by the governor and they were imprisoned in San Felipe. And you can read a bit about their individual accounts and what was said. There were also some, if you like, I wouldn't use the term harshly or judgmentally, traitors, who left the Scottish camp at night and for bread and water traded information. And there's some very nice accounts from the Spanish military commanders of what they were told about the numbers, the number of men and women, what provisions they had, what arms they had. So we do have a wealth of detailed information, which has been quite useful. And one of the great, or for me, interesting finds that I discovered in the Panamanian National Archives was Spanish intelligence reports between Venezuelans and modern-day Venezuelans and modern-day Colombians. They're talking about Admiral Benbow, who, of course, was the great scourge of the French and the Spanish. He was a great English military admiral and based out of Port Royal in Jamaica for decades in the Caribbean and died and is buried in a lovely church in downtown Kingston, Jamaica. But he, in fact, the Spanish say, of course, the English or Scots never mention this, but the Spanish reports say that Benbow helped the Scots repel Spanish attacks. Now, that's quite interesting, and it goes into how, when it became a failure, the Scottish narrative wasn't to say, we got ourselves into this mess, this was Spanish land, it was a mistake from the outset. It was blame the English because of the governor of Jamaica's proclamation. The English were always our enemy, but they make no mention of the fact that the English Navy and their great admiral were assisting and helping them. So history is always complex and multifaceted and difficult.
And written by the winners. He could have been a plant, couldn't he? Benbow is like, well, we'll help the Scots in there, and then adopt the colony later. Let them do the hard work.
That's entirely likely. Yeah. And the English did send spies. Yeah. There's a chap referred to in the contemporaneous diaries called Captain Long, and Captain Long was a bit of a drunk, I think, but it seems pretty clear, and that was certainly the Scots' view at the time, was that he pretended to be a merchant, but was in fact a English naval intelligence officer dispatched from Kingston to go and have drinks and dinner with the Scots in Caledonia and find out what they were up to. And he described the bay as a crabbed hole because it was. I mean, I've been down there and getting in is difficult. And once you're in, it's quite difficult to get out because of the winds and the sea. And so it was a very good in theory, defensive position, but the Scots didn't make a number of mistakes about where they placed their forts, etc. But, you know, the landscape is so difficult. I mean, I'm reminded of that because I was sailing in the San Blas Islands in February, and just driving, you can now drive from Panama City to some of the ports on the Panamanian side, and then you jump on a boat. But if you've ever driven across the main cordillera in Panama from Pacific to the Caribbean, it's a heck of a route, a heck of a journey, and very difficult.
Yeah. So, I mean, you just mentioned it. You mentioned that you've been down there. You mentioned it. You know, on the Amazon write-up, or one of the writers, they have you as a machete-wielding author. So you were down there with the machete researching this. And what did you come across, aside from, of course, beautiful, you know, I would say probably first or second growth jungle, and maybe some, I don't know, colonels, as we'd say in Colombia, or some indigenous original settlers there. What, I mean, tell us about this region and your experiences in it, because, I mean, it just had to be so impenetrable back then.
I mean, certainly back then it must have been extraordinary and so difficult, and is vividly brought to life in the diaries. And my journey was obviously so much easier, but there were certain aspects about it that did feel as if they weren't be that much removed. What I did, I mean, it's impossible to make contact with the Amerindian tribes, the Kuna Indian, or they're now called the Guna Yala, a G rather than a K. But when I wrote the book, the appropriate cultural term was Kuna. But the Guna Indians still live as they would have largely when the Scots were there, in cane huts by the waterfront and fish. And the great ease for me was I could fly from Panama City to the nearest airstrip, get off the plane. But then the adventure began there, because I couldn't arrange anything. And so I arrived with a small rucksack and some dollars, and I sort of explained what I wanted to do. And the first tribe were very keen to welcome me, but it soon became apparent after some time of negotiation and sort of boredom on this extremely hot little cramped island that they weren't going to let me off anytime soon without either spending lots of money or taking up a lot of time. And there was a lot of talk about the Sahilas having to make decisions, and they had to wait for them, and that might take some days, but they would have to all meet to discuss the request. And I didn't really have time for this. So I think, you know, in hindsight, and being desperate to get there, I possibly made a slightly naughty decision to go out on a boat trip. And then as soon as I could, I jumped off the boat and went off to another island and spoke to another community of Indians, and they were much more receptive, and they gave me accommodation and food. And the very next day, they took me in a lanchita, a little dugout canoe with an outboard, and we went sort of 2 hours down the coast, with, you know, pretty unpleasant sea, quite a swell, and got there, and I was able to spend a whole day on the site. And your question was, you know, what can you see? Well, you see this amazing bay, just as it was described in the accounts, with the mountains up on the mainland. But the bay sweeps around to this wonderful sort of jutting out peninsula where Fort St. Andrew was. And you can still see the remains of the bricks, which were used to make a bread oven, which I saw. You can see at the far end of the bay the defensive trenches that the Scots had dug to defend their position. But apart from that, nothing. It's just, I imagine the Scots had mostly planted cane huts, and they would, of course, have had cannons, but most of them were taken back on board the ships because they'd reached this truce with the Spanish and were allowed to take their cannons back on board their ships for the journey home. So there's nothing, apart from the oven and some of these trenches, nothing to see. There must be graves there, but nobody's ever been able to find them. And archaeologists have gone out from the UK. Colonel John Blashford Snell's been down there and spent, I think, 2 weeks in one of his operations in the 1970s having a dig around. But very little's been found. But, I mean, it's immensely atmospheric and powerful. And I find it very moving. I gathered wildflowers and tied them into a bouquet, and eventually when it was time to leave, just as the sun was setting, I laid them on the water and said the Lord's Prayer for, you know, everybody who died in this place, Scots, Spaniards, English, Frenchmen, all sorts of people had come there seeking their fortune, seeking to bring the Protestant Church of Scotland, lots of different reasons, and many had died, and it seemed important. However difficult it is for us to understand what we were trying to do, these were very brave people, and it was right to respect them.
Definitely so, and I'm sure there are remains and graves in there. Just, but maybe these days, you know, when we have our sort of, you know, the heat measuring drones and so on that can see when where Earth was moved, even back then, it's, we'll have a Discovery or Amazon Prime
document,
which will do it. I mean, truly fascinating stuff. I mean, we were talking off mic, and I was in Suriname doing some research many, many years ago about the Scottish settlement there, and just people just don't know. And it's our quest for knowledge in these things. I love it. I love these stories. But you really got into the thick of it. I mean, spending time in the Panama archives is what a great experience to see this. You got out there for a day. I mean, it reminds me a little bit. There's a book written by Edward Marriott, which is called The Wild Shore, about Bluefields and then the settlements up there. And of course, it's all, you know, around shark fin hunting, but he goes well into the history of the Mosquito Coast. And he knows it. And it's all connected, that whole Central American corridor there.
The Bluefields were popular for the Campeche trees, and the wealth, the famed wealth of these trees led an English surgeon called Lionel Wafer to write a tract about the Darien, and he was a contemporary of William Dampier, the great English pirate, and it was Lionel Wafer's book that fell into the hands of William Paterson that led the Scots going to a little beyond Bluefields, further down to Darien. So it's all interconnected,
it's
as
all
you say.
Interconnected.
You know, it's fascinating, but it is amazing how people simply don't know. And I was struck most by that because I didn't just follow the Scots footsteps in Panama. I follow the footsteps in Jamaica and Cuba, and obviously in Edinburgh, but I also went to Charleston. Ah. And when I was in Charleston, obviously I went to the Historical Society, and I was asking if they had any records or archives on the Scots who were blown in on the rising sun in 1700. It was the flagship of the second expedition. And it came into Charleston in 1700, and there was a huge storm. And one of the Presbyterian ministers, Reverend Stobo, went ashore to give a sermon. And when he was giving a sermon, a huge storm came into Charleston Bay, and it sank the rising sun, killing about 100 people on board. And he said, "This is divine providence." So he stayed. And your viewers, your listeners rather, will find this interesting. So he marries into Southern aristocracy in Savannah and Georgia. And his great, 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 great grandson was none other than Theodore Roosevelt, the American president who stole Panama from Colombia in 1903 through the villainy of Philippe Bonavarria and all this fascinating history, for the very purposes of building the Panama Canal. And there is probably no greater visualization, conceptualization of William Paterson's Door to the Seas and Key to the Universe than the American Army building the Panama Canal in 1912 in what should have been Colombian territory. Of course, the Colombians negotiated, didn't they, with the Americans in the late 19th century and couldn't reach a deal. So back to Charleston, I'm in the archives and I'm going through lists of books they have, and they said, "No, we don't know anything about Darien." And I find something called the Stobo Bible, and the librarian gets it for me. And here in a manila envelope is Archibald Stobo's Bible that he took from Edinburgh to Darien and must have held in his hand in the wilds of Punta Escocés and preached. And it is now in an archive, a vault, in Charleston. And I have to say that was one of the more emotional moments, tracing the footsteps of the Caledonians to come so close to one of them. And back in the days before having to wear white gloves, I could hold the Bible that he had held. So that was a great moving moment. So it's been a fascinating journey. And I mentioned Colonel Blashford Snell. My final anecdote is I write in the book how the Scots had taken thousands of clay pipes to sell. And I'm told that in about 1972, Blatchford Snell led an expedition down to Darien. And it was big news in Panama back then. And Torrijos, Martin Torrijos, because that was his son, the president, Omar Torrijos,
his father.
And Manuel Antonio Noriega went down, and they had a bone supper in the jungle in Darien in 1972. But when they were there, they discovered a cache of clay pipes, and they dug them out of the mud in Caledonia. And I'd seen these clay pipes in the air-conditioned homes of very wealthy Panamanians when I was working there as a lawyer in 2004, 2005. And I'd always wanted one, and I thought this was great. And I remark on this in the book. And then after the book was published, a package arrived at my office. And I opened it up, and there's a little card. And it said, "Dear John, I understand you would like one of these. I enjoyed your book enormously. Yours, John Blatchford Snell," who was a British explorer and a British military officer and is now retired. And I open up a little book, and there is a perfectly preserved clay pipe taken from Scotland in the late 17th century and lay in the mud in Caledonia for 200 years before being discovered in the late 20th century. So that was tremendous. And history is an amazing thing. It is for me a living thing. I'm an attorney. I'm a lawyer. That's my day job. But it proves that all of us can engage and do some research and find something new about where we're from and who we are and learn things about ourselves. And it was a great joy to write both the history and particularly the travelogue chapters of the book, which was a great experience. And really, the book's a tribute to those brave Scots who, as your listeners will know, went to a very remote part of the world, but a place of great beauty.
I'm speechless with the stories, these final stories, the Roosevelt connection, of course, Blatchford Snell, the clay pipe. What, I mean, amazing. And finally, I mean, we've got to wind this down, and I know my listeners are thrilled with your anecdotes and your recollections and this book, and I can't promise they'll buy them, but as a Scot, you know, McKendrick, so on, did you have family? I mean, is there a connection, or is it just the Scottish connection?
It is just the Scottish connection. I couldn't find any traces of my family back to anyone who travelled or anyone who invested. But, you know, I come from a solidly working-class family, both with roots in the north of England and in Ireland. And a lot of my Scots family were blacksmiths and growing up in Perthshire. But I felt a very close affinity. I first visited South America, I think, when I was 19. First visited Colombia in 2003, when I was a few years older. And I've been backwards and forwards to Latin America and working in the Caribbean. And I've been all over Colombia from all sorts of places. I mean, it's probably my favorite country in South America. And I will never, never forget spending 3 or 4 weeks working in a coffee farm in Quindia.
Nice.
I think Colombia is spectacular. So there's a part of me which understands every Scot's desire on a miserable wet day to think of travel somewhere exotic and tropical. And I think at the end of the day, a lot of the people who ploughed their money and their lives and their resources into those ships to sail from Edinburgh to come out to the Caribbean and Latin America were imbued with that spirit of adventure, which Scots still have to this day. And of course, one of the great benefits of the failure of Darien and Caledonia was the Act of Union, and then rightly or wrongly the British Empire, and the Scots played a huge role in that British Empire, a huge role as Scottish traders in Colombia, in Argentina, in Chile, and of course all across Africa, Southeast Asia, and many other parts in between. So the Scots didn't do too badly out of it at the end of the day, and I suppose Darien was a stumbling block at the beginning of that journey.
Yeah, if you had to use a host to come over. Have you ever been in the British Cemetery in Bogota? Because
no, I've never. But next time I'm back, I'm going to look you up, Richard.
Yeah, because there are members of the British Legion buried there, because of course it was given by Simon Bolivar for the, those who died. And there are obviously Scots who are in that, you know, the let's say the forlorn hope are all in a mass grave. There are no names.
Yes.
But those who are officers, there's one from, was it Kirkcudbright? Yeah, there's, and it's on his tomb. There it is, you know, Kirkcudbright. He's like, wow, you know, the distances traveled back in those days, far further than today. But let me take this moment to say thank you so much for sharing your time and obviously your knowledge about this. I mean, you've really gone deeper than anything I've ever read about the Darien exploration. And I wouldn't say it's a failure. I think we need to look at it in through different lenses on this. And I think you've uncovered that a bit for my listeners and certainly for myself. For those of you out there who are interested, please take a look. I know it's on Amazon. It was published in 2016, so not so long ago. Darien, A Journey in Search of Empire by John McKendrick. You'll find it. It's easy to find. And I will put the link, obviously, on our Facebook page and on Twitter and all the other social media ills that we need to play with these days. But thank you again, John, for your time and such an enthusiasm towards something that really clearly is quite personal to you.
Richard, thank you very much. A great pleasure to join your podcast.
It's always a pleasure. This is Columbia Calling here in Bogota. I've been Richard McColl. We're still under quarantine in Colombia. As always, stay safe, stay well, heed the warnings. You know, we're in difficult, extraordinary times. Hopefully at some point we can come out on the other side. Well, that's me signing off for this week, episode 332. Next week we'll be back with a social project taking place in Cartagena with Alex Rocha, and he'll be telling us about what's going on in Cartagena right now with regards to the pandemic. So be sure to listen into that one. Thank you again to John McKendrick. That's me signing off this week. Bye-bye.